Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are in with an episode here as we kind of head towards the end of November. Excited about that because that should mean, and potentially, the end of the tropical storm season for 2020, and I think we'll all be happy to see that part of 2020 go. We'll have a little bit more on that in a second, but we can't talk about anything else until we bring in co-host Sam Bradley, who is really the one who's on top of everything. How's it going, Sam?
Well, I'd like to think so, but you really think there's an end to hurricane season? Come on now, Jamie. It's 2020. Think again. What, speaking of which, and speaking of the weather, Becky, we had two nasty storms. In fact, we had our first Cat 5, both of which, the last two, did some real damage in Costa Rica and Nicaragua. Can you help us with that?
Yeah, so Hurricane Iota made landfall earlier this week in Nicaragua, only about 15 miles south of where Hurricane Eta made landfall. Just a few weeks earlier. So unfortunately, the same part of Central America has been hit with two very, very strong storms. Iota is only the second time in history the two hurricanes have made landfall in Nicaragua in a single season. Really just historic stuff happening here and in just about the worst way possible. Both storms have brought significant rainfall and significant wind. So with Iota making landfall, and bringing that wind and rain to nearly the same spot, regions that were not recovered, obviously, because it just happened 2 weeks ago. We're seeing torrential rainfall, mudslides, immense flooding. Really, it's a humanitarian disaster unfolding. It's really, really tragic.
Well, we've had some of the same pattern on the Gulf Coast, too, just with multiple storms backing in and coming around and going back in again. It seems like a no-win situation. I think there's still some storms forming out in the ocean, right?
I mean, I'm scared to like say no, but no. Nothing is expected in the next 48 hours. There is in the 5-day outlook, there is an area with a 20% chance, kind of in the Bermuda and areas south region. But at this point, I'm not going to say it, but there's nothing out there right now. We'll say that.
That's like saying quiet in the ER, Jamie. You know that one. So does Joe. And I'm sure our guest does as well. So, Mr. Kyle, we've been getting a lot of wind here in Colorado. What kind of pattern are we looking at?
Oh, Sam, yeah, we definitely have been quite windy. A very destructive wind event took hold on Saturday, actually. It canceled COVID testing at many testing sites across Colorado, especially in the Front Range as well, where wind gusts were up over 60 miles an hour. So thankfully, though, that was a well-forecast event, and folks were able to take the proper precautions. Not too many negative impacts from that because, again, communication was great from the local meteorologists, from the weather service down to our TV weather forecasters. And so we were all prepared for it. Looking ahead, we're actually in Colorado. We're going to be staying largely high and dry, unfortunately, here in the short term. And it's going to be cooling down for us, thankfully, as we get towards this weekend and into next week. So hopefully those resorts can keep making some of that artificial snow. We'll get some of that natural on top of it, but looking further ahead over the week and weekend, heavy rain in the central Mississippi River Valley, as well as in the eastern Great Lakes, and continued flooding in the Carolinas as well.
Oh, lovely. The poor Carolinas, they never catch a break either. Well, we have Dr. Joe with us tonight. Hi, Dr. Joe.
Hi, guys. How is everyone?
Well, we're good. How are things in Memphis?
It's been a lovely few days, so no complaints at all. Things have been very nice here.
Very good. Well, we're not going to have as much fun tonight as we usually try to do because we're going to be tackling one of those topics that's not fun, but is very, very important. And in case you weren't aware, this is Mental Health Awareness Month. And we've talked about this occasionally in the past. All of us have talked about some of our own experiences with this. And it's interesting because, as the meteorologists have told us, they see it very differently, but yet everyone is affected by it. I frankly can't see that anybody that does this kind of work in EMS cannot be affected by it. Would you agree with that, Joe?
I would indeed. It has been an especially stressful year.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah, add COVID on top of everything else. That's just what they need. Well, fortunately, Joe recommended a friend of his, a very good friend of his, who happens to be a psychologist, and he knows this stuff, and so we've invited him in. So, Joe, why don't you tell us about Randy?
Well, I'll be happy to. Dr. Durandy DuPont is, first of all, a longtime friend and colleague in the world of disaster medicine. He's been involved with disaster response, going back as far as Three Mile Island, if I remember right, Dr. D. You've certainly been around for a very long time. We are very glad to have you on the show tonight. Please say hello and kind of finish filling in the holes I've left in your extensive resume.
A lot of holes, Joe. We won't talk about those, though. Joe, it's really great to be here. I've enjoyed working with you over the years and respect the kind of work that you do not only for the firefighters but the Tennessee Task Force. So it's a real honor to be here with you.
Well, we appreciate you. Randy, let's start with, and this is a subject in and of itself we could go on for 2 hours with, but what are some of the risk factors related to psychological injury and stress? And obviously, this is not just EMS, even though we're addressing that primarily, but we've learned from our meteorologists, and Kyle is also a ski patroller, it kind of hits every level.
Yeah, I was listening when you were talking about the hurricane season. I'm from New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, and something that really does get my attention. I just got an email from one of my colleagues down there talking about some of the damage from the last hurricane they still haven't recovered from. So that brings it home. That really does.
So what are those factors? I worked on a helped form and worked on a CISM team for the ambulance company I was working for. Mm-hmm. As a peer counselor and a trainer, I was still very limited in what I understood. What we tried to do was prevent PTSD in people, but I don't know that we had a real good grasp of that. By giving them resources to help them work through some issues. But a lot of times we just didn't know, or a lot of times they wouldn't come to us. What are some of those signs and issues we should look for, knowing that somebody's going off in a bad direction?
Yeah, and that's a struggle. Although I think one good thing about your profession is that you all are really closer to each other than many people are who are not in that kind of work. And that way you'll know first who's struggling and who isn't. And I think the hard thing there is to figure out how to intervene, how to talk to someone, because I think that's the critical element. One of the strongest factors that y'all have going for yourselves that I think really can make a difference has got to do with the morale of the unit. If the unit you're working in has a good morale, if they can talk to each other, they can support each other. I know a lot of times EMS and other personnel give themselves a hard time about the aspect of being a family, but I think that's still true. That y'all really can have that capacity to support each other, and that makes a big difference. Again, the research is pretty strong on that. If you like, I'll talk a little bit about some of the risk factors I think that are important to kind of pay attention to, particularly after you've been involved with a major incident. So that's okay with you, I'll go with a couple of them.
Oh, absolutely. Please do.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I think people need to look for is that there's some things that the research is pretty supportive of. And the first one has got to do with multiple exposure to trauma. A lot of times, if you grew up in the old school, you thought, hey, the more things that I'm exposed to, the stronger I get, the more I can handle. And it turns out that's not true. Actually, the more you're exposed to, the greater your risk is on the next exposure. So it's really important for people who have had a lot of experience, who really have been in this field for a long time, to really take care of themselves in a really important way. And what that really does come to mind is that one of the things I have found with EMS workers is that like a lot of professions that really want to help, they're very helpful and they're very kind. but they really don't know how to take care of themselves. They're not even sure what that means. And so I think it's important for people who are in EMS to stop and ask themselves, okay, you know, what kind of risk am I under? What have I been exposed to? What does it mean to really take care of myself? So I would start with multiple exposure to trauma as one of the first things to look for and to ask yourself, where are you on that kind of issue? There's another one, too, that it's got to do with the nature of what a person goes through. And some of the work that I was involved with Oklahoma City, later on what they did with some measurements, and they could actually tell from the distance, the proximity to the event, as to who was more likely or less likely to get some sort of stress disorder related to the event. So we're looking at proximity being an issue, and that literally means how close you are to the event. I have found in my work that sometimes that could mean just a matter of feet. If you're outside the house instead of inside the house, that can make a big difference. Obviously, one of the other issues is the whether you have to go hands-on or not. That seems to be a factor. I think the other two factors I'd look toward in terms of proximity of the event is the intensity of the event, which I think is sort of self-evident, but also the context. That is, that individual, if there's somebody involved in that event that you not necessarily close to, but that you know people who are like that, or if you have children yourself and it involves a child, those are very stressful and challenging parts. I'll tell you two more factors that come to mind that's based on the research that I've read, which is, first of all, that sometimes it's necessary in your profession to be able to disassociate from what goes on, from the emotional concomitants of an event. And that's not a bad thing. That can be a very healthy thing. That's what allows you all to be professionals and do the kind of impressive job that you all do. But at the same token, there's some evidence that if that dissociative response lasts too long, if it goes on for 3 months, if you don't have a chance to process, puts you at greater risk and really does raise concerns that one should tend to and be involved with. I'll tell you the last one that I want to jump, that jumps out at me, that I've always been intrigued with, is some of the research on family exposure. And what that means is that were your parents or grandparents involved in trauma events themselves? Now, you wouldn't think that that could be passed from generation to generation, but it seems like there's some evidence that it can be. That is, what are the messages your parents gave you about how to handle a trauma? Were those good messages that were healthy, or were they messages that let you end up not really being able to deal with it and be at more risk? So just to throw out those things, I think that that's kind of some things that come to mind and that supported by the research and would suggest indeed that EMS workers really need to sort of pay attention to and kind of try to evaluate the event that they've been exposed to.
Well, that last one's not one I would have given much thought to. That's really interesting. Jamie, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this so far.
Well, I've been something that's been near and dear to my heart, mental health in general, and certainly the health of responders and really everyone in healthcare, especially in this day and age where people are dealing with so many stressors in the hospital setting that they weren't necessarily used to. I'm sure that this whole topic is getting a lot more focused now inside the hospital as much as we used to focus on it outside in the field.
Yeah, I would think COVID's wearing everybody out. Joe, you can speak to that. And also, he's talking about the team effort and the family. I think that's absolutely true for you, Sar, as it is for DMAT, right?
Yeah, no question about it. It's definitely a family event. But I think Jamie touched on a really important topic here, and that is, as it's ever present in 2020, the impact of COVID on our efforts to take care of each other when we're forced to socially distance and mask and stay away from each other at a time when everybody's under even more stress than usual. So, Randy, can you touch on that just a little bit, the challenges in today's world, as it were?
Yeah, I think you're really right, Joe. That is that, we all get used to certain support mechanisms and don't even realize that's what they are. And then when they're taken away because of the need for care, to be careful and to have social distance, it's a challenge. And I think that I've really found that to be true, that I think that one of the things, and I think you and I have talked about this before, Joe, is that and people that work in your field and in the field of basically public safety and other fields like that, they really have to be, in some sense, they have to distance themselves from the danger. They have to have some degree of denial in order to be able to do that job. But it makes it also the case that that can put them at more risk when it's important to reconsider and to then be able to take additional safety measures. I have noticed that when I sometimes work with firefighters and police and others and EMS workers as well, of course, that sometimes it's hard for them to make that conceptual shift and realize, wait, there is a different type of danger here. So I think that's indeed a real challenge. I have a colleague in Fort Smith who's a psychologist also, and he's written some on this topic. And one of the things he points out is that with what's happening with COVID, we just don't have our habits anymore. And people laugh about that, but habits are really a lot of times just keeps us healthy. You know, we develop them. Hopefully they're working for us. They reduce our anxiety. They impact on depression. They give us more hope because we're used to things being predictable and something that we kind of expect. On the other hand, I think COVID has kind of turned all that a bit upside down, and we need to kind of remember that, because otherwise I think we'll lose perspective and be at more risk for things along the lines of anxiety and depression.
Oh, my God, there is no normal anymore, is there?
Isn't that true?
Really? Well, just for your edification, Becky, tell him a little bit about the world of meteorology and some of the stressors that you guys deal with.
Yeah, definitely, Sam. I feel like there's varying levels, but I think the most sort of critical one is forecasters working when major weather disasters hit where they live, where they work. So this, I think, most frequently impacts, you know, National Weather Service meteorologists, you know, who may be working through a hurricane making landfall, and they're in the middle of, you know, forecasting a major weather event where they know exactly how bad it's going to be, and they're also trying to, you know, help their family be prepared, protect their home, all of that. We've seen this with tornadoes hitting places like Moore, Oklahoma, and Joplin, Missouri, and the outbreak, you know, in Alabama. And then you have forecasters who, you know, they're meteorologists, and they're going out and doing disaster surveys, and they're seeing things that they are not trained or prepared to see. You know, they're seeing houses completely destroyed, children's toys strewn about. They talk about the smell, and there's just not really, until I think pretty recently, been a solid way to address that. There's a lot of resources that are going towards that now within the National Weather Service. But it's one of those, I think, stressors that's led to a lot of vicarious trauma for a lot of these forecasters, you know, doing some of this parts of their job that they're not really equipped to do and to handle from a psychology standpoint.
Good point. Randy, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I was intrigued what you were saying about the fact that I hadn't thought about the fact that so many weather forecasters are going to be working in their own area, which is going to increase the risk, because when it becomes that kind of personal, that's a real challenge. I know for myself, when I was encouraged to come down to New Orleans after the storm Katrina, I ended up not going initially because it was too close to home. So I feel for you, and I know that those are real challenges. I would tell you that I'm glad to hear that there's a recognition of it, because again, the whole connection that people make to each other is really a pretty critical element, not only in terms of what you're talking about in terms of major events, but in terms of the COVID you were talking about, the response to COVID. That is that people have struggled sometimes to find ways to substitute for the experience of support, the intimacy that they've had. And I really think it's really important to find imaginative ways to make that work. I would think that'd be true too for those that are involved in weather forecasting, that can they find support groups? Can they put them together? Can they make a difference? And be able to talk through some of the issues, particularly when it does involve family and those that they know so well.
Well, Becky's a big advocate for mental health in that arena, and she's pretty outspoken about it. So we're glad she's doing that and can help drive this along to make sure they have more assets. But another invisible group is 911 dispatchers, Mr. Kyle, which you happen to be. Why don't you shoot some thoughts to Dr. Randy on that?
Absolutely, Sam. It's been historically, and it still is in many areas, where 911 telecommunicators, those dispatch professionals, they are still classified and regarded as clerical workers, right? You answer a phone, you process information, type it in, your partner dispatches it, and then the field responders take over from there. And historically, it's been that thin yellow line behind the scenes, but more and more, it's coming into the light on the types of compassion fatigue and these other vicarious traumas that dispatchers have accumulated over many years. I mean, when I started, I was told, hey, if you make it beyond 2 years, guess what? You break the mold. And that's not really something that's encouraging to start with, but that's really the metric. And you think about it, people don't call either 911 or even a non-emergency number for fire, police, or EMS to offer kudos or gratification, right? Every call, it's someone's worst day. Everything from, you know, something that may be minor, like a parking complaint or some type of civil issue, to a domestic dispute where you hear gunshots in the background, you hear children screaming, you're trying to control a caller and keep them safe, but you can't do that because you're not on scene. You can only give those instructions over the phone. So that's really an accumulation, and it's unfortunately only recently become really recognized and addressed in many public safety answering points. And still to this day, many of my good colleagues that were there when I started at M Dispatch have left, in part because of that accumulation of those vicarious traumas.
And he's not even in a major metropolitan area. I actually worked with a fire dispatch who was, and I know exactly what Kyle's talking about. What are your thoughts there, Andy?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I was very intrigued. One of the things, just coincidentally, Kyle, I do a lot of work with dispatchers, both in the work that I do with trauma recovery, but also in the work I do with police and fire around diversion and trying to impact on the calls that come in. One thing I was struck by, I was thinking when you were talking about it, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, when we started our program, it took us 3 years to realize we'd forgotten the dispatchers. And that's a terrible thing to admit, but it was true. It was almost by accident that we realized, wait a minute, we didn't include them in the program 25 years ago. So 22 years ago, we tried to begin to make sense out of that and not let that happen. I think that a lot of times you'll hear from even firefighters, EMS personnel, police, that they realize that the dispatchers rarely get the closure that often the police and fire first responders can get, that they're really left more in the dark trying to figure out what happened. And a lot of times they know who the person is, the firefighter or the police officer or the EMS personnel person that's out there. They know them, and they know them personally. And so they're very concerned and very, very upset and trying to figure out what to do. I think that that's a real challenge, because one thing I have found is that they're always short on dispatchers. Short on good dispatchers, short on good 911 operators. So they get overworked. They don't get to be, I'm always finding and fighting battles to make sure that the 911 operators and the dispatchers get equal time to be able to have the kind of work that we do with them. But that's more of a challenge. Same thing with training. We have found it hard to include them in the training sometime because they're so in demand and the departments are always short. So I do worry about that quite a bit. And then I think the other part you're saying makes a lot of sense, that it's really critical for the professional recognition to happen, that they get the same kind of rewards and recognition. I don't think that always happens. A lot of times it's basically once they're done, it's back on to the next call. And I do worry about repeat calls and repeat events that happen over time. That's a real challenge. So, again, it's admirable what you do, and you're right. I have seen a lot of people that really can't manage it, not to mention the incredible multitasking that you have to do. I've sat with dispatchers through a number of shifts throughout the country in some of the work that I do, and I've always been impressed with the fact that I know I couldn't type, talk, and process and make call all at the same time. I would not be a good dispatcher. So I'm impressed with what you're doing.
Well, especially for a guy, they say guys aren't the multitaskers that women are, but I don't know. I think Kyle's one of them.
Yeah, Kyle, we're not going to listen to that kind of. We're not going to hear that.
But therefore, and Kyle has put in the sidebar 100% yes on what you're saying, that, you know, it's about time that dispatchers get acknowledged. One of the things I remember doing the training with the fire dispatchers was teaching them what happens on a wildland fire, because that is such a different element. And we had them because we had a lot of foothills and so forth in that area in Northern California. And it's like, if you don't hear from a crew in a certain amount of time, you better suspect something's gone wrong and get some people out there. So these are things I wouldn't have had any concept of because they can't perceive it. So, yeah. So, Jenny, you worked as a volunteer firefighter. And back to what Dr. Randy was saying, talk about working in your own backyard. There's a real good chance in that environment that you're going to run into somebody you know.
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that, because we were running around recently and just driving through the county, and you know, there's one road I drive down, and I mark, this is a crazy thing I do, but I've marked the houses where I've either had to pronounce somebody or had a dead patient for one reason or another, the dead houses, and I know where they are. I drive past them all the time, and I just, you know, I happened to say something out loud just the other day, and my wife noticed it, and it's like, she just said, that's so weird. And I was like, it's just is what it is. I remember every single one of them, and you know, they're ever present. When you work and live in a community, especially a small rural community where you know a lot of people, you run into the family members in the grocery store, and it can wear on you. You know, it's something that you do to serve your community and your neighbors and your friends, and it's recognized, and which is helpful. The people recognize the sacrifices that are made, at least in part. But yeah, it's not easy.
So, Randy, would you just consider that a good coping mechanism for Jamie?
Which part? I didn't quite make that last part out.
Is that a good coping mechanism for him, or does he need further help? That's just kind of his way of dealing with things.
Yeah, you're talking about the original thing he was talking about. Yeah, I was thinking about that when he was talking about those things. And to be honest with you folks, after working with the fire and police departments in my own area long enough, don't feel bad, Jamie. I do something similar. That is that when I drive down a street, I can remember every intersection that the police and the fire have told me something that's happened on that time. So I think that that's probably giving you a little more control. But I feel for you, because one of the things I have seen when I've worked with firefighters that arrive on a scene is if there's a family member or somebody they know there, it makes a big difference, and it's really hard. I think that I work a lot with some of the areas outside of Memphis in the more rural environments, and I'm always amazed by the fact that they have an advantage. They have more connectedness than we have in a big city a lot of times. But the downside of it is that they also know everybody that's in an accident, know everybody there, and have a story, or at least they have a spouse or somebody that has taught one of those children. And it's a very challenging environment. So I do feel for you in that way. And I've always admired that kind of volunteerism. So my hat's off to you, sir.
That's got to make you feel better, Jamie. He does the same thing.
Yeah, afraid so.
Now we got disaster workers, and Joe and I have both worked in that field for many, many years. And one thing I remember post-Katrina was we had quite a large team that deployed there, and they actually ran into a very difficult situation at the Superdome and basically had to run for their lives, if you will. So I was in charge of setting up a debriefing when they came home, and I was gobsmacked. These people didn't know what they were doing, what they were feeling. We brought in mental health pros that were actually working with GMAT at the time. It was scary. And then in another year, we did a big exercise, and a lot of people started reliving some of that. They'd come to me and go, oh, we got a problem with this group over here. So we had kind of an ad hoc diffusing session. And then year three, they're still dealing with it. And we had another one. And when we had this third one, it all kind of fell out. Everybody had taken that long to process it. And one of the things I learned was paramedics learn to deal with death. Paramedics learn you got to leave them behind. They learn you can't save them all. We do the best we can, but we can't save them all. Nurses generally will always have some level of closure. People go to the ER, they go to the floor, sometimes they go to the morgue. But when you're dealing with disaster patients, they tell you about your family that just floated down the river and you don't know if they're alive or dead. You never get closure on that kind of thing. And having had to leave the Superdome with patients that they knew desperately needed the IVs they were flowing, there were babies being delivered, it was hugely hot, there was a lot of heat issues, and having to walk away with that, they came away with a huge amount of guilt about that. And I'm scratching my head and going, well, it's what you had to do. You know, you had to look out for yourself. Do you have any thoughts on that? And then I'd love to hear Joe's perspective on that.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you do bring that up. As I mentioned, I didn't go to New Orleans originally, but several years afterwards, I did end up going down there and working with the police that had been in the Superdome, as what you're describing. And I will tell you that they were left with a lot of residue that other officers from the city who had worked in different parts had not been left with. And it was still it felt as if it was an event that had happened recently. So I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense, that the recovery period is very long and that for some people it's very challenging. One thing I'll add that I think is important to keep in mind is that when people are trained well, that actually does vaccinate them to a large degree against what they're dealing with and what they're facing. But at the same token, people who are very well trained and are very capable find it harder to handle things that they can't control. That is, that there's pretty good evidence that when a disaster happens where they can't impact the outcome, it raises the stakes and makes it more challenging. So I think that I'm really glad that you were there with them and continued on with those kind of anniversary actions, which I think is very much the case with an event like that. But it is a challenge, and indeed I have found that people really do continue to struggle with some of those issues. I think to some extent, that they'll manage to cope and they'll get better. And I do want to give a message of optimism. That is that even though there's some good chance that most EMS workers will find that they are indeed at some point exposed to symptoms and find symptoms related to an event, the chances are very good that they're going to recover. Probably about 80% have some sort of symptoms, but 85% then recover. So it's really, I think, very important to kind of keep that perspective and realize that despite how painful it is and despite some of the things we're bringing up today, the recovery rate is very, very good. And really, if people take care of themselves, that they respond with some sort of a treatment if needed, if things are lasting past 3 months. The nice thing about this is that there's very good recovery, and often without medication, there's a lot of very impressive techniques that are available, and that the research is encouraging and moving us towards. I think the danger is when things fester for more than 3 months and one doesn't address them. After about 6 months, you run the risk that becomes a bit of a part of you, and it's much harder to deal with. So, again, I think it's early diagnosis, early treatment, support from each other that really does make a big difference, and one that changes the culture of a department. I really think that what we've seen, Joe, and I think you'll attest to this in the Memphis Fire Department, that it's a much more open department, much more supportive than it was many years ago, and that people really do their own debriefings, and that's really the best thing when they do them before we get there. So my hat off again to you for working with those in the Superdome. That was a challenging place.
Yes, it was. And, Joe, you know, thinking about hospital folks, I mean, paramedics are kind of used to an outside, unsecure, uncontrolled environment where you're taking someone out of a very different scenario in a ER and throwing them out into the street into a worst-case scenario. Maybe that's not so much the case for USAR, because a lot of them are firefighters and so forth, but have you seen that occur in the hospitals?
Absolutely. I think that's not only is the situation out of control, but they're in an environment that is not their normal environment, and that's stressful in and of itself. So, it's really challenging to take folks out of an environment, particularly like an emergency department, that's a very closed space and a very tightly controlled environment. And put folks in a location to try to do patient care where the security of the environment now is completely up in the air. And if you're not used to that, it can be, I think, a huge stressor for you in many ways. And Randy can touch on this. I would certainly think that would be a compounding factor for the development of some long-term issues when you have that additional stressor on top of the stress of the event itself.
Yeah, I think you're right, Joe. The more that people have training and prepared for events, the better off. The less that it's like what they're used to in their regular work environment, I think the more challenges that they're facing. I know that just as not every physician can do the kind of work you're doing and be able to go with those task force, the same thing's true for psychologists. Not every one of them can come out from behind the desk and deal with individuals that face kind of what you all face. So you're right. I think it takes a great deal of training and a lot of preparation, and the more that it's different from one's environment, the more one has to really work on simulations and trainings, or else I think there are a pretty good risk.
Amen to that. Jamie?
Yeah, Randy, I'm curious, you know, with everything going on with COVID right now, I've seen quite a bit in the news and lots of stories about, you know, ICU nurses and ER nurses dealing with a lot more patient death. Especially in situations where they're trying to act as spiritual go-betweens between the patient isolated in the unit and their family through FaceTime calls and things like that at moments of death. Is there anything you think going on now that's going to be able to help those people adjust and deal with what they're facing right now? Because this is, you know, at some point they're going to come down from this heightened awareness and activity level. And I'm afraid we're going to lose quite a few nurses from the profession after this is all over, said and done with.
Yeah. And I think you're right that the real risk period is not going to be as much right now, which there is a different type of risk, but the real emotional risk comes later on. That's true for EMS in general. I find that a lot of times it's after retirement, not during the events, because they get used to a certain strategy of responding. They just keep going. Same thing for emergency room nurses as well, and other nurses at high risk, that they get used to functioning and they keep functioning that way. But sometimes it doesn't give them time to process and allow things to go on. So I do hope that the hospitals, the administrators that are responsible for those hospitals, are planning ahead and saying, okay, we may be able to get out of this eventually, which we certainly expect and hope we will. But I wonder if they're also considering what's been the toll it's taken on individuals there. And I think that the toll manifests itself in different ways. It really upsets me when I hear about a firefighter who might have developed a reaction to things and begins to behave erratically and do things that wouldn't really be consistent with their behavior. We really need to have places and programs that are available for those individuals that don't just get left behind. So I think you're right, and I think I have the same concerns as well.
Joe?
Yeah, I was just sitting here thinking about, I guess, the variety of people and sort of the long-term issues. And Randy, I would really love to hear a little bit about your experience at Three Mile Island. I know that's pretty far in the past now, but, you know, we don't think of workers like that as part of a disaster response component necessarily, but that certainly was a disastrous situation. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Joe, it really was one of my first exposure to basically large-scale trauma. That is that I was in a position where I was doing assessments that that are required by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That is that they require that all people with reactor room access have psychological screening. So I was doing that kind of work and was at the sister plant to Three Mile Island right after the disaster, and they were moving those individuals to that plant. And it really did give me a unique perspective on what goes on with individuals. I did find that those that had the most control, at least in being in charge of different responsibilities, were the ones that struggled the most. They were the ones who really felt a great deal of what was mentioned earlier, a lot of the survivor guilt that they made it through, but that perhaps it left people with higher risks for cancer and other things in the area. But also, I think that they just simply were reacting to the stress. those that could do well were those that kept their habits up, that kept their routines going, that didn't change their interests or their hobbies or their exercise that they were doing. Those people seemed to be doing a bit better than those that were in a situation where they were more responsible, but also, I think, responding poorly to the event. You're right about that. I think that people don't think about the workers in a plant as being exposed to trauma, but they certainly were in a position where that was the case. I think that was true in a lot of disasters. If we look at what happened in Oklahoma City, for example, where I also did quite a bit of work, again, you find that that individuals who were not necessarily part of the rescue squads were also experiencing a great deal of trauma. I won't forget how I called to make my hotel reservation, and the person that answered the phone was immediately, when she found out I was coming, she said, she says, you must be one of the mental health people that are coming. And then she decided, she just started spontaneously telling me her story and what she was struggling with and the fears that she was left with. So you're right, it's pretty far-reaching and pretty, it can be pretty hard on people, just being close to something like that. I know that's true for my relatives that were in New Orleans. I was fortunate enough to be up here during Katrina, but I know that for many of them, it's been a long road back.
Well, that touches on something. You know, when you're talking about Oklahoma City, I was at Ground Zero, Joe was at the Pentagon, and I found that when there's an act of terrorism, when something is done intentionally, it's a whole different thing than just treating patients after a natural disaster, because this is not a natural disaster, and some of us are still dealing with it. So, thoughts?
Well, I think you're right about that, too. And the issue there becomes one of how does one deal with one's own anger? That is that the anger at people that would do things that would be that destructive and that pointless. I think that is something to deal with. And I think in a small way, a lot of EMS workers face that when they face parents that don't put their children in seatbelts. And they find themselves hard not to become angry at those individuals that didn't take such precautions. So I think that dealing with the anger is an important part, and it's really hard, I think, sometimes for people not to internalize that anger, not to take it out on themselves without realizing it and turn to methods that aren't coping as well. Again, I really want to encourage you and your listeners to really take some sense of responsibility for each other. That is to go ahead and do as difficult as it is to go ahead and talk to someone when you see their behavior changing and when you see them becoming doing things that you know are not in character and that are self-destructive. That's not an easy thing to do. It takes great courage, I think, to intervene and talk to someone. But I've had people come back and tell me stories of where a fellow firefighter has come back to them and thanked them for that because they felt it saved their lives in a very different way than normally that one would think of with firefighters and EMS workers. So again, I want to encourage you and your listeners to keep up that kind of not only that good work, but also taking care of each other.
Amen to that. Another thing that's a big one for me that I don't think we nearly have enough training on is families. In the disaster setting, how families react to us coming home. It took us weeks to wind down from Ground Zero because we had a whole new sense of normal. And I know Joe can relate to that. We didn't want to hear that the washer was broken and the kid did this and the dog did that and chewed up this. I mean, we were not in a headspace to deal with that kind of thing. And they didn't understand it. They knew that we were gone. And especially for men coming back and having to deal with things that are broken. And because, you know, the wife had been waiting all that long for those things to happen, not understanding where our heads were in a totally different place. Can you help us with that a bit?
Well, yeah, again, you're bringing up a good point. That is that I think that it's often difficult for families to understand the perspective that that rescue workers and others bring back with them and that they develop. Okay, that is that sometimes the small stuff is really irritating and difficult to deal with. And I think it takes a special family to be able to support someone through that, but it's important that they understand it. And not everybody does. Not everybody understands those kind of issues. And not everybody understands when to be patient and have that perspective. I kind of was thinking when you were talking about how firefighters and paramedics tell me that if the washing machine is going to break down, it's always going to be when they're on duty. It never seems to be when they're home.
True.
So, you know, right. And so they always do that. And it's frustrating because they then can't play the role that they're used to playing. That is the helper who comes and makes it all right and makes it work. And that's, I think, an additional challenge. I like when departments have programs for families, particularly when it starts in the academies, that that they really do give them a chance to get used to it when they have other family members from more experienced firefighter and paramedic families come and talk about what to expect. It really, I think, helps cushion what's going to happen and helps explain that. I'm impressed with the ones that tell me, hey, I can go home and, you know, my wife or my husband or whoever knows to leave me alone for a little while, give me that recovery time and understand that I need that. And I think that's an important and essential part of what's going on. So I want to encourage that, but I would also like to encourage one thing I've seen about paramedics. I've never seen a paramedic that didn't work three jobs and always managed to do something else.
Amen.
So, yeah, and that's, you know, I worry because they're putting themselves at risk. Sometimes I've met one that say, look, I really know when it's time to stop and when to get away. So I think that's important to kind of know what you can do and how to recover. But again, I think you're right about families, that it's a challenge. I think always what I find is that those in your field have to struggle between how much do I include the family, even though some of the stuff that I've seen is really not easy to talk about, how much do I protect the family at the same time? And that's very much of an individual decision. So I think one has to kind of figure out what one's family can do and cannot do, and what they can handle and can't handle. And I think as we move through that decision-making process, the real question is how to do all of that and yet not lose the intimacy and support that you need from family. That's a lot of challenge, and that's, again, why I admire it and why the psychologists that work with me have such admiration for what you all take on. It's certainly not for the pay. It's got to be something that's inside all of you all.
Yeah, I'm the poster child for what you were just talking about. I was doing primary paramedic training, working with an ambulance company, and working in an ER. And these poor students would end up in all of those places going, you're everywhere. I think I made them a little crazy. I'm not sure. But lastly, you've kind of been touching on this all along. Everybody processes differently, and we know that. We have a problem with denial and invulnerability. I remember a time when one of our paramedics was killed on a highway, and I unfortunately had to respond to that. But we had to advise the other units in the field, and the difference in how they reacted was interesting, because some of the people reacted more strongly, even though they didn't know this guy, because he worked in an outlying station. And I scratched my head for a while and realized, you know, when you're in this business, you kind of build up the sense of invulnerability. Well, we take care of everybody else, so we're not supposed to be affected by this. True?
Yeah, I think you're making a good point, too, though, is that you're right, that basically I think that one, I think that you have to develop a bit of a fatalism when it comes to approaching some of the risks that you all take. And that can take a lot of different forms. So I think that you're right that indeed when that's penetrated, when you see somebody that you know that has been involved in a very bad situation that perhaps doesn't make it, it brings it home in a way that's often difficult. And I think that that's a pretty critical time. What I have found is that people that make it through will talk about how, while it's very challenging and difficult, they come out of it as a very different person. They feel like they have a much more depth, much more emotional depth. Sometimes they have stronger spiritual beliefs that lead them and give them comfort. So I think those things are indeed challenging. But when you see another worker who's hurt or who's injured, it really clearly hits home in a way that is very challenging. I hope that departments have learned to give people time off. That is, that not necessarily away from the station, but simply time to be there without another call and to have a chance to recover and support each other. I remember, I'll never forget, a story that the paramedics told me when I first started working in this field. And they were talking about how that basically there was an incident where a paramedic was held hostage, and that person had a gun to that paramedic's head. And the police were called, and the police had to shoot the individual who was holding the paramedic hostage. And they gave the police 2 days off to recover. And I asked what happened to the paramedic who was being held hostage. And the answer was they went and did 10 more calls that shift. So,
oh, my God.
True story. Didn't make that up. And indeed, that struck me as what I was struck by that. And I really thought, no, this is the kind of thing that has to change. We have to find a way to recognize that despite how you all are heroes to very many people, you're all still human, and you need to be able to recognize that and be able to have that recognized by the people you work for.
Thanks for that. We do appreciate it. Wow. Well, that's one thing I always had trouble had trying to talk the battalion chiefs into letting this crew be off duty. You can't sit there and work with them if you're going to pull them out on a call. No, no, no. Anyway, that was just me.
You're right about that. Really, you really need that time. And I think departments are becoming better about that. I know our local departments are certainly becoming better. And it's an important thing.
And I think private ambulance has gone a long way in terms of having a team that knows what they're doing. Final thoughts, guys. Joe?
Wow. Where do you start? Randy, you know, you've covered a breadth of topics tonight, all of which are important. And I think really send home the message that this is a very pervasive issue that we need to learn to deal with, and we need to recognize that we need to deal with it even more, and that the current year and the current situation has really compounded all of this in many ways that we don't even see yet. So we need to keep our eyes and ears open and watch out for each other.
Yeah, I think Amen we're going to need it. A 2020 debriefing for the whole entire world. But that's another story. Miss Becky.
This has been a really fantastic episode. This is a topic that I always enjoy hearing, you know, a wide variety of perspectives, and to hear all of you speak about, you know, some of the things that you've experienced and the lasting repercussions from that, I think is valuable for you to share, a bit cathartic, but also for everyone else who is, you know, has gone through something like that or will go through something like that. There's so much benefit in sharing our stories, you know, what we've experienced, what we felt afterwards. And I hope that continues. I think social media has aided that in, you know, getting to at least connect with a wider variety of people and hear what they've gone through. So I just thank you, everyone, for, you know, being a bit vulnerable in this episode, and to Dr. Randy for, you know, sharing his, just as Joe said, breadth of knowledge on this.
And thanks for what you do, Bex. The meteorological world needs you. And Mr. Kyle, the dispatch world needs you.
Indeed. And again, to echo what my colleagues have said here, Randy, this has been a fantastic discussion tonight, and we appreciate you sharing your insight here. And I would encourage our listeners to remember that, you know, stress injury and recovery, right, it's a two-way process, both for the individual and for those in the leadership positions. And in leadership, now more than ever, monitor yourself and your others to detect those signs of stress injury and empower your teams to take action. You know, have those mechanisms in place, those support systems in place, because we're going to continue to need each other more now than ever going forward.
Absolutely. Randy, final thoughts from you.
No, I just, again, I know it sounds, I'm not just being trite when I say this. So my psychologists that work with me tell me that that's the best work they ever get to do is the work they do with you all and other first responders, because it's very clear that people go into this profession that you have for the right reasons. They just want to help others. And again, I want you all to stay healthy so that you all can continue to do that, but also enjoy the kind of retirement and things that you deserve for working so hard.
Well, and it really helps us to have somebody like you that has taken the time to understand what we do, because we're not your everyday person, as you have eloquently communicated. Jamie,
I'll agree with that.
So, Jamie, we got a lot of education. I think all of us learned something on this episode. Of course, education is where we always end up, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And, you know, I just want to, as always, thank Joe and his vision with Paragon Medical Education Group for helping us put this podcast together for these last 7-odd, 8 years, whatever it is we're going on now. Joe, you know, I know that you guys include mental health aspects in all of your training evolutions that people can get signed up for, find out how they can customize it to their own particular situations. How can folks reach out to you and find out more about what Paragon has to offer for them?
Well, after I get done being stressed out over doing a podcast for 8 years, welcome folks to give us a call. They can find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group. And they can always reach us at the Disaster Podcast.
Excellent.
You love it, Joe.
And Randy, is there any particular place folks that are listening to this episode can find out more about your services and information on how to reach out to you?
Sure. They can just write me an email at the university. It's pretty simple. It's like my name. It's R. DuPont, just like my name says. And then it's at memphis.edu. So feel free to send me an email and I'll get Joe to consult and we'll figure out an answer based on that.
Excellent. Thank you very much again for coming on tonight. We really appreciate your time and energy. Becky, where can folks find you?
Well, I will be around the Disaster Podcast Facebook group and over on LinkedIn talking about emergency management and disaster communication.
Kyle, how about you?
Well, Jamie, I'd love to connect with our listeners to continue the conversation. They can find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, and all the social media spaces under the handle WX Kyle Nelson.
And you be safe, Kyle, because I know we're going to have you off the show for a couple of months coming up as your schedule has shifted around. But we'll have you back sometime in the spring, and we'll look forward to when you can come back on.
Absolutely. Ski season getting ready to go into full swing here. So got to lock down and get ready to rock and roll.
Excellent. Stay safe, bud. Sam, how about you?
Well, I'm stressed because Kyle's leaving and poor Becky's stressed because she's going to have to pick up the slack. But it is what it is, isn't it? Well, like Kyle said, all the social media spaces under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, certainly in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. What about the PodMedic?
Well, you said it. PodMedic is my handle on most social media locations, so please look me up, friend, or follow me there. Reach out and become part of the community at the Disaster Podcast Facebook group as well. We'd love to have you there. Very active group of people there, including many of our experts from past episodes, our hosts, and just some amazing collection of talent and expertise from just listeners in that group. So please become active and join the community. And of course at disasterpodcast.com, where on each episode post, there are links to subscribe to the show so you don't miss any of our great episodes. And I count this as one of them, Sam. It's been a great discussion and I'm glad you were able to pull this together and get with Joe to bring Randy on the show.
Well, we thank Joe for that, and I think Randy's going to be on our short list from now on, so we can hopefully get him back. And I guess kind of the focus of this is first responder stress isn't our everyday stress.